Lecture 22, Current Applications, Bioethics.
It is hard to imagine an area of moral, political, and legal landscape that is more contentious and more fragmented than the area of bioethics and medicine today. There are such fundamental disagreements about these matters that the debates can seem interminable. This lecture will not try to oversimplify what is admittedly a very complex question, but it will attempt to show how a natural law approach to ethics would apply to the range of current issues, including the areas of abortion, infanticide, stem cell research, euthanasia, physician-assisted suicide. I will give the bulk of the time just to considering one case, namely abortion and infanticide, and to try to show not only what the content of the natural law contribution is, but also, by this example, to show how one uses a natural law approach in practice, and then, in what time remains, look at some of the other issues more briefly. Natural law analysis of the question about abortion and infanticide is a question about, of course, the permissibility of the taking of the lives of the unborn, abortion, or the lives of the defective newborn, infanticide. And a natural law approach would urge that there is a need to consider the nature of all of those who will be in any way affected, as well as other factors that enter into any ethical analysis, things like the intention that the agent has, the likely consequences over the long term, the circumstances. This is very typical of natural law analysis, namely that you have to focus on those three issues explicitly. What kind of act? On whom is it being done and what is their nature? What is the intention? What are the likely consequences? What are the circumstances? Now, in questions of abortion and infanticide, we need to ask some of those basic questions about nature. And I would like to remind us right here at the start of one of those principles that we saw at the very beginning of this lecture series, and ask you to bear it in mind and consider, in the abstract, whether you think this is a good principle, and then see how it seems to apply here. The principle is this, that both legally and morally, there is no justification for a difference in the way we treat individuals, unless there is a difference of kind, but rather the beings that are of the same kind need to be treated in the same way. Arbitrarily treating individuals of the same kind differently would be unfair, would be a kind of discrimination. And we saw in those early lectures, it's a point worth repeating here, that there clearly is a plurality of kinds of things in the world. Denying that there is a genuinely distinct set of kinds would entail unacceptable consequences. For instance, again, to take just a really obvious case, if there were no such difference of kind, then there would be no difference between killing a human being and killing a horse. But rather, we say that it's wrong to kill a human being because of the kind that's there, where to kill a horse or to kill a cow, one shouldn't be arbitrary about it, one shouldn't be trying to torture the poor animal, but that there's not the same moral prohibition. Now, in the cases we have at hand here, abortion and infanticide, those who are going to be most deeply affected include, of course, the mother, include the physicians who would be involved, but especially include those beings whose lives will be ended. And if one can ascertain and be convinced that the individuals who are going to be slain are innocent human beings, the natural law does not allow that they would be treated differently than any other innocent human being, and hence that they be protected by the right to life. This is, to insist again and again that there's a need to be concerned about all the individuals, but especially to focus on those who are most deeply affected, and in this particular case, since it's a case of killing, they are affected in a way that cannot be undone. Now, to establish that those to be affected in this way are human strikes me as a biological question. Namely, it can be shown that they are members of the human species, and this can be shown in any number of ways. It can be shown by direct observation, if one can see what they're doing, what they look like, their structure. One can do this by DNA analysis. One can do this by noticing that they were conceived and are in the process of being born from human parents. that even those who are born with genetic defects are still human beings can, I think, be established by the fact of continuity in their lives. That is, they have not yet undergone that kind of transformation that is death, some kind of transformation into members of another species, but rather are still members of the same species and will remain so if given simply normal nutrition, normal care. But death would be a radical transformation, what in the technical language of philosophy is called a substantial change. Were they not alive, and alive indeed as human beings, the question would not even come up. The inability that a defective newborn might have to perform some function is not death. It is not the transformation of that being into a being of a new species. It is rather the inability to perform a certain operation. And hence, I think you can hear, even in the definitions that I'm using, those discussions that we had near the beginning of our course about the importance of proper definition. Namely, to try to define a given species in terms of its function is something which can ignore, it can fail to appreciate some of the structural features, and hence there's a need to make sure that our definitions are definitions in structural terms, and that our consideration of functions will help us to focus on what structural features are important, but that the definition can't be content simply with analysis of function. The question of species membership, then, for the unborn or for the newborn defective, turns on the question of the kind or nature. One can test the genetic composition, the DNA, for the fact is that every cell in our bodies contains our own distinctive DNA signature, that is, our individuality as the specific person that we are, as well as the kind of creature that we are. The tissues that are involved in every one of our organs is always recognizably human. It's very interesting when one has the chance to discuss these matters with a forensic pathologist, because they're very concerned with finding tissue and determining what species it came from, and if it's human, what organ it came from. The complexity here and the DNA signatures are extremely important. Now, given those biological questions, and when those biological questions are determined adequately, then one returns to the moral question, and I return to the point about natural kind and fair treatment. Namely, there is no non-arbitrary demarcation point for species membership at any point in an individual's development. From the time when the gametes, the sex cells, have been joined and fused at the time of fertilization, the new being has a different DNA signature than either its mother or its father. Whether this is done in the natural place within the uterus of a woman, whether this is done in a test tube in the case of in vitro fertilization, all of the changes that occur thereafter for that newly constituted individual, and a newly constituted individual which we can know as a biological fact by current scientific testing, all of the changes that take place thereafter are not changes in the nature, not changes in the kind of being, but rather are matters of the growth and unfolding of the species-specific determinants and the person-specific determinants that are already identified in the DNA structure. Now, given this, I think it's possible to formulate a natural law argument, and the argument has three steps. First, only a difference in kind or nature warrants difference in treatment. Second point, the nature of the zygote, the embryo, the fetus, even though we call these things by technical names, the nature of these is the same as the nature of the infant, the child, the adult, to which we also give different technical names. It is the nature of a human being at one or another stage of that nature's development. Third, there is no private license to kill an innocent human being. That is, there's no license that we have arbitrarily to take an innocent individual's life. The conclusion that I think follows from this by a natural law argumentation is that induced abortion, that is, the deliberate killing of an innocent human being at this stage in the being's development, is unwarranted, for it would be a matter of arbitrarily treating innocent beings that are the same in kind, namely all human, treating them differently. Now, given that kind of analysis, the natural law, I think, is clear about the point in general. A sound ethical analysis of this issue, like a sound analysis of any issue, also requires that we consider questions about intention and consequences and circumstances. The first point, then, I think to be made is that if the analysis of the nature of this act had determined that the act in question were somehow morally permissible, one can ask, you know, with respect to how we care for the young, about the kind of food we give them, the kind of time we give them for play, or the way in which we make them go to school, there we would have questions about activities which were all permissible. And at that point, once we had decided that the act was permissible, then we would go on to considerations about the intention that a person has in doing a given act. But in a case like this, where the action strikes me as intrinsically immoral because of unfairly treating a being whose nature has been established, it is impossible to proceed with the analysis of possible intentions or likely consequences. Utilitarians, for instance, like to focus only on consequences and say, there's no act that is intrinsically immoral. Rather, we try to weigh the benefits and the burdens. Or situation morality suggests that we focus on the intention, why we're doing something, as though that were the main emphasis. The natural law analysis, however, suggests that one may only proceed to questions about intention, which are important, and questions about consequences and circumstances, which are important, but one may only do so if one has a permissible act by this first test. The reason? Because one may not do evil so that good may come. Even if there are tremendous good consequences, one may not do something that one knows to be an evil. Even if one has a great motive, it is morally impermissible to do evil that good may come. Why? Because to do so would involve directly willing an evil means for some end that one desires. Whether the end that one envisions is good because it is well-intentioned, or because one judges that there will be greater benefit than burden, important as these considerations about consequences and intention are, the end does not justify the use of immoral means. Now, I said at the beginning, and I want to repeat here, that I recognize that these situations are often very complex. The analysis that I've given so far is intended as a basic analysis. When the situations become more complex and we need to make a moral evaluation, natural law theory recognizes this, and it tries to handle it by the use of an additional principle. It's called the principle of double effect. This was a principle which was historically developed in order to handle things like self-defense. May one use lethal force in one's own defense if one, for instance, is being attacked and one is innocent and the person doing the attacking is somehow rightly considered to be an aggressor? And the natural law said there's got to be a way to defend the use of lethal force, force which would even result in the death of the attacker. This likewise happens in the case of the defense of one's country. Let me talk first about the principle of double effect in general, and then suggest a way in which it might apply to some cases of abortion when the situation has grown more complex, and see what you think about the matter. First, let me do the principle of double effect in general. The principle of double effect is a principle that is designed to be used in moral analysis when what we do is foresee that the action that we are intending has a double effect, or perhaps a plural effect, but for simplicity's sake, let's just take two, namely, a good effect that we foresee and intend, and an evil effect which we also foresee, but which we in no way intend. And the question is, may one undertake the action which has this double effect? According to the natural law analysis of the situation, there are four conditions that must be met if we are permitted to do the action under this principle. First, the action itself that we perform must be good or indifferent. It must be something which by its nature is not intrinsically immoral. Second, the good that the agent intends must not be obtained by means of the evil effect. That's the causal line. It's a matter of not doing one thing that's evil so that another good thing will come. It's a matter of keeping the analysis in terms of one action that truly has plural effects. The evil effect is a kind of side product, a side effect of the same action. Third, the evil effect must not be intended for itself, but only permitted. We can foresee that it's happening, but we don't ourselves choose it. Fourth, there must be a proportionally grave reason for permitting the evil effect to occur. That's where we get into the analysis of consequences. Let me give one simple example of a different nature just to sort of show how this works. If, for example, we were considering a fireman entering into a burning building to save the lives of some individuals, the entering into the burning building is a situation of danger, and a fireman undertaking this can foresee that entering into this has possible bad consequences, his own death or injury or the death of his fellow firemen. And yet entering into this, especially if one has the right gear on and has enough training, well, the action itself is quite good. And the entering into the building is not in any way done for the sake of trying to have the fireman die. If the fireman had a death wish, this is a person who needs therapy and shouldn't be undertaking such a procedure. But rather, presuming the reasonability of the fireman and all the training and the very careful rules that they follow in entering the building, the fireman does so. And in doing so, he intends to save some individuals. He in no way intends his own death. He doesn't intend that his family should profit by the insurance policy if, in fact, he is somehow injured in the line. Nor would the evil effect, if it were to occur, be the cause of the good effect, but it would truly be a side product. If the fireman enters the burning building and dies or is severely wounded, that isn't what saves the party that he's trying to save. But rather, it's a byproduct, it's a side effect, it's something that may happen in the course of things. The evil effect is not being intended for itself. The evil effect is not the cause of the good effect. The evil effect is simply foreseen. The fourth condition, the matter of analyzing the likely consequences, is extremely important. One may enter the burning building, say, to save persons, but one may not risk grave danger to one's life to save merely pets or to save paintings or something of the sort. That is, the risk would have to be very minimal in order to save something else because the proportions wouldn't be handled well. There are lots and lots of cases where the principle of double effect comes into play. My point here in using that example is simply to try to illustrate the principle in general. Namely, all four conditions have to be fulfilled. The violation of any of them would make the evil somehow directly willed and not just an incidental byproduct for which the agent would still be responsible. The principle of double effect does not eliminate responsibility, but rather it makes it possible for us to deal with conflict situations without incurring moral guilt or blame for the evil effect that we are foreseeing and allowing, but in no way desiring. Now, when we turn to the question of abortion, natural law theorists have examined the possible uses of this general principle of double effect, and often they have agreed that there are some scenarios where it may apply. This is not going to be a blanket justification for the permissibility of abortion, but rather for some foreseeable and well-determined scenarios. For example, in the case of a pregnant woman who is discovered to have a cancerous uterus. In that particular case, the removal of the cancerous uterus will certainly produce a good effect for the patient, namely a removal of the cancer. And as such, it's a recognized medical procedure that is a good procedure. The death of the baby that could come about is handled as a tragic but foreseen effect of the hysterectomy. It is not the means to the good effect, and you can prove that by analyzing if the baby were killed but the uterus were not removed, then the good effect that is desired, namely the restoration of health, would still not be achieved. So it's not the death of the baby which is the cause of the good effect. In the scenario that we are envisioning here, the death of the baby is in no way desired. This, of course, is often a matter of what medical technology at a present time can achieve. There are certain times when even a baby who is premature can be saved outside the womb. And that question about viability is very much a question that has to be handled in terms of the science and the medical technology of the day. Finally, the situation here does involve two human lives, and there is at least some proportionality that would not have been the case if the deliberation had turned on some other factor, such as weighing the baby against a future career, or weighing the baby against financial considerations, that we do need to have tremendous care for the women who are involved and tremendous compassion, and at the same time, in our moral analysis, we have to also have great care for the baby. It's a matter of caring for both because we have done our analysis of the nature of both. Now, my efforts have not been to try to settle all the questions of abortion, but rather to show in the time allowed what a natural law analysis could contribute to the situation. Let me now turn to some other questions that might well be worth discussing and show how natural law analysis can similarly be helpful. And I think I'll be able to go more quickly through them because we've done our work showing how the natural law argument is made. Right now, there are great questions afoot in our country about physician-assisted suicide for those who have been incapacitated by age, illness, or accident. And I think these are a group of cases which can be fruitfully subjected to natural law analysis. The analysis will be very similar to what was just considered above in terms of abortion and infanticide. First, once one has established that those to be affected are human beings and indeed innocent human beings, the natural law requires the protection of their lives as a right. Namely, it is something which is only good and true and right because of their nature. But rather than laying out the entire argument again, I think I've done that in the first part, it may be more helpful to address certain additional factors that tend to come into the consideration of this question. These issues, of course, are very complex, and I have to admit here that there is no way to cover all the important aspects here. Rather, I simply want to stress how one might let natural law approach the case. Unlike the question of abortion and infanticide, where those who are affected are not yet able to speak for themselves, it can sometimes be the case that the individuals who are ill and are in great pain may themselves be seeking the assistance of a physician to end their own lives. Or even if they have lost the power to speak and the power to communicate, they may already have done so by a living will. It is important to note here a great variety of related issues. But at the broader level of these issues, namely euthanasia in general, as well as in the more specific issues that are correlated with euthanasia, such as decisions about those who are no longer able to express their own preferences, what we have is a case where we're dealing with human beings and asking whether there is a right to kill, either to kill oneself or to commission a physician to do the killing. While those who are inclined to a utilitarian analysis tend to argue in favor of euthanasia, in favor of physician-assisted suicide, and sometimes even a policy to euthanize those who are terminally ill but who cannot any longer express their consent, it is my view that a natural law analysis will forbid all such activity. The utilitarian case, as before, will consider only that fourth factor, namely the relative products of the action, the relative consequences, and will try to weigh benefit and burden. And will not only try to weigh benefit and burden, something we must do, but will try to insist that the whole moral analysis is in terms of benefit and burden. Perhaps the easiest way to understand the point is to consider how there are natural rights and wrongs that are already decisive for the question, and we in the United States have a special way of doing this when we think back to something like the Declaration of Independence. I do not mean that the Declaration of Independence has legal standing for us, for it does not. Our legal standing begins with the Constitution. But in terms of the moral analysis, those lines in the Declaration that pertain to our basic rights talk about those rights as inalienable, and they list among the inalienable rights the right to life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness. Well, when we focus on a right to life and call it inalienable, what we are saying is not only that it may not be arbitrarily removed by someone else, but also that it cannot be arbitrarily waived. That is, it is unable to be given away by us just as it is unable to be taken away by someone else. If either of those things were the case, then the right would not be inalienable. The counterexamples which perhaps come to mind on whether these rights are indeed inalienable help us understand the issue. Doesn't, for instance, the soldier who enters the battlefield, or the religious martyr, someone willing to witness to the faith even to the point of death, don't they involve giving away our rights? I would say no, that instead they are cases in which one person will undertake an action in which one can foresee that another person, namely the enemy on the battlefield or the enemy in matters of religion who is going to make a martyr out of this poor soul, the enemy is somehow taking a life. But the right is something that does not belong to the soldier or to the martyr to give away. Rather, one has to see those individuals, the soldier who is standing under obedience for the common good of the country or the martyr who is standing for the truth of the faith, are simply witnessing to something else of very high value, and they themselves are willing to put themselves in harm's way, but they are not yielding their right. One may not have a martyr complex, for instance, that seeks death, nor should we rashly toss away soldiers in a battlefield. Natural law, then, does enter the question, I think, by reinforcing natural rights and urging us to consider that euthanasia fails to respect those natural rights and instead tries to weigh the matter only in terms of the likely consequences and, in doing so, fails to give an appropriate analysis of the situation. Natural law does not require, never has required, that we use every possible means to save a life. And so in the case of someone who is very ill, someone who is at death's door, even someone in great pain, it is not required that we use every means, extraordinary means, to prolong that life at all costs. Rather, what it forbids is that there be any direct attack upon human life, even an attack at the patient's own request. There is instead a natural law obligation to try to find palliative care, to try to find ways to relieve the pain. And in my own studies on euthanasia, it has been a tremendous revelation to me of the new possibilities in pain management that are now possible. Palliative care, I think, is an extremely helpful development. So, too, on this question, as on the previous question about abortion, there may be instances where we need to invoke the principle of double effect. Some forms of pain relief medication, for example, have side effects. And when we've got a side effect, we're in that double effect situation where the action we're performing, the giving of a medicine, will relieve pain, but it could also be something that makes a person more vulnerable to death. As before, one has to examine the matter carefully to make sure that one's motives are pure, that one is not trying to bring about the death more hastily, but is only trying to relieve the pain. The relief of pain, of course, is not a causal factor in producing the death. And hence we are okay on that second condition, because the relief of pain is not the cause of producing the death, and hence it may well be permissible, and indeed very prudent, to administer certain forms of pain relief, even though there is a byproduct that means a greater vulnerability to death, so long as they themselves are not the medicine which turns out to be a poison and in some way causing the death. Let me turn in the time that remains to another question that is very much in the news right now and deserves our consideration, the debates over stem cell research. This, too, I think, has the same kind of analysis, and so we'll be able to rely upon what we have covered earlier in this lecture. Once again, I'm making no claim to have a thorough analysis of this, but only to try to show how natural law applies. Let us presume something here for the sake of argument. Let's presume that research on stem cells will actually be helpful. Stem cells are those cells that have not yet become differentiated. In our body, our tissue cells are very different than our nerve cells, are different than our blood cells, are different than our muscle cells, and so on. They have been differentiated in such a way that the structure of the cell is now very highly determined to do a particular job in the body. A stem cell refers to a cell which has not yet been differentiated so as to have just one particular biological function. But these are cells that are still open to development in various ways for various different purposes in the body. What I'd like to presume for the sake of argument, something which has not yet been scientifically established, is that it will actually be helpful to manipulate these cells to remedy various diseases and afflictions that are of a genetic order or can perhaps be cured by a genetic therapy. I cannot stress enough that as yet the evidence isn't in this is even going to work. But let's presume for a minute that it will work. Natural law analysis can be helpful when we're considering the source for these stem cells. As in any natural law analysis, one needs to consider the nature of those who will be affected by the proposed action. When we are trying to gather stem cells from an existing adult for the sake of the research, the cells can be obtained without any ill effect upon the donor. So if they were to try to take them from me or from you, it would not cause our death or indeed cause our injury. And this invokes one of the main principles that is involved in the moral analysis of medical research, namely that experimentation should either directly benefit the person experimented on, or if it's not going to directly benefit the person experimented on, but will affect and benefit other generations or other people, we should at least not in any way harm the person who is being affected, the donor. Experimentation on stem cells from adults is thus in general permissible. But experimentation on embryonic stem cells is different. In this case, the stem cells are being obtained by removing from already existing but very, very young embryos precisely those portions of the embryo's structure, the DNA, which contains the determinants of a new person and which will remain unique to that person throughout the whole of his life. Precisely because the destruction of the embryo is entailed in trying to get stem cells from embryos for the sake of research, in order to do these various biochemical developments, it seems to me forbidden by the natural law because the natural law prohibits taking any human life, and this is a new human life. Hence, the argument relies upon identifying the nature of the being, and natural law analysis seems to identify a new human life from the moment of conception until we experience that radical discontinuity that we know as personal death. For this reason, even embryos seem to me to enjoy the protection of the right to life. In the next hour, we'll try to turn to yet other moral questions.